read. Here we're at Rivka.
All right, page 29, bottom paragraph. Oh, I'm sure I'm in the right spot, yeah. Okay. Well, what caught my eye was talking about Yeshua, who was the living Torah, and his message was to emulate his life of observance. Through his lifestyle, the world would find healing that would indeed produce the Messianic age. Yeshua demonstrates powerful truth, the truth that the Messianic figure that we have conjured will not be a Messiah to usher in the days of the Messiah. But since each of us is the seed of Messiah, we will be bringing it in. We are the Messiah. So I saw that and I was thinking, okay, well, we all have to take part in bringing in the days of the Messiah. So
absolutely.
I just saw that and I never saw that before.
Very good. So,
I thought that was cool.
I have a book that it's not a recommendation. I just have the book, okay? I bought it because the title was really cool, and I probably should have just kept the title in my mind and not bought the book, right? But it does support a very, very interesting idea, and that is that we are a Messiah. And in many respects, to many of the people that we have in our circle of influence, the biggest picture of Messiah and Yeshua that they ever will see is you. Mm-hmm. And we're told in several places to emulate Messiah, emulate the Talmudim, etc. So that's exceptional. And we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. My beloved, would you take care of that?
She seems to be doing very well.
Yeah, she's making her rounds. So I'll do everybody. Thank you.
Yeah,
put her in that room. Okay, I like that. I like that a whole lot. You ready, Sheva?
Mine is also on page 29, but it's the paragraph above hers. in the middle of the paragraph where it says the Shema as an organic whole stands for commitment to the whole of Torah, oral and written. I took the word organic, and I mean, I know what the word means, but if you'll really take, if you look, use the dictionary, it's not using artificial chemicals, not using art, and that just really resonated.
With no organic.
Yeah. It really spoke to me, and I thought, wow, you know, because this to me, it seems...
It's the real thing.
Evil, so real, and so I'm fed, and it's, there's, and even this weekend, Melissa said, Mom, there's so much missing, and that when you, that when I talk to her, she's like, oh, there's the part that's missing. So this was interesting to me, especially that word organic.
Okay, very good. Let's see. Yeah, I think that's another thing. We have pictures of her in class as well. She's the 10th class here with her mother and father and grandmother and
niece.
Uh-huh. Here... The idea of all of this is that, as we have said in the past, as Eminence has said, as I have postulated, that the reason that the first tractate of the Mishnah, the first opening section of the Mishnah, the quintessential beginning of the Oral Torah, the reason it starts out with the discussion on the Kiryat Shema, or the recital of the Shema, is because the Shema is the core principle for all of Jewish belief. So, Judaism has no such thing as a theology. And by and large, they don't even have what we would refer to, or what we might have chosen as a doctrine. This being the case, you try to nail certain things down, and Judaism if you want to make the quintessential idea of Judaism, excuse me, and understand what they believe, it's just Shema. But almost all Jews will basically agree on the centrality of the Shema. Beyond that, who can say what they will do? One Jew, three opinions. Or three Jews, half a dozen opinions. So, very good. I'm glad you looked up organic. you ever at Habato, Mother?
I don't have anything this evening, thank you.
Okay, very good. You're rich.
I'm sorry.
You're not, that's
not
fine. That's fine. So, but only well, sir.
You are a Ben Elohim.
What's wrong with that statement? Or let's say it this way, what's different about that statement?
Well, one majors on a particular facet in Christianity, whereas we major on the other facet. That he is a mature one who is able to discern good and evil, has his senses even programmed
absolutely
to understand that. Whereas when others read it, they're reading it as if God is a biological father of him and so forth. Although it would be accurate, I think, to say that Yeshua is actually the firstborn over all creation. He is the Son of God in that sense.
If we go to Sephod, absolutely. Okay, we cannot do that in this particular genre, but in Sephodic material, yeah, we can go there. Okay? But you should, so what you should really try to do sometimes, and it doesn't bother me at all, you should check me out. In other words, what I'm saying is, look at what it says in your favorite version that you read all the time, and then look and see how I translated it, and then do a comparison here, and then you need to, once you've looked at the comparative piece, then you need to start asking questions. Why is it like that? Or why was it translated that way? Okay? Why did I do that? Okay, so here it says, picking up on this line just that Adon Yoel was starting with, said, you are a Ben Elohim.
So I've forgotten whether or not I looked at the Greek on that. Does it have the definite article
yes,
in there?
Yes, it does. Yes,
so how
does.
Can you...
How can I fudge that and play with it? Because I can.
You are the all-powerful.
When you look at this, it can contextually, he can be called the, but we know he's not the only Son of God. Mm-hmm. And so if we know he's not the only Son of God, we're only speaking of one of them. And to say one, the, puts a definite article there, would imply that there's only one. And there's not, right? Excuse me, I'm not putting feathers in my hat. I'm a judge. Ben Elohim. Okay? So, am I the Ben Elohim or a?
A.
So, you see why we can do that? And he's the, when we look at Mark 1:1, we say that, you know, he is Ben, you can say Ha, or here as we did here, a Ben Elohim. When you do this, what you need to see is that he is the sum of all the wisdom and the teaching of the sages that were before him. And so this gives him considerable amount of authority just by being, a quintessential judge. Okay? Very good. I like that.
Well, I didn't read it. I started it real quick right before class started. But I can't wait to get into it. And what something that Yoel had said was about the Christian churches and about that sort of thing. You know, being really, The very first line on page 26, underneath the commentary, it says, it should be evident now to our readers that Yeshua was first of all Jewish. That is what the Christian churches need to get instilled into their head more than anything else.
You're right.
You know what I do? I just use footnote 44 to do something I generally do. When I talk about Yeshua and his being Jewish, I use the Nazarene codicil to make the proof. Here in John 4 and 9, what's going on in John 4 and 9?
The woman at the well.
The woman at the well. She calls him.
A Jew.
How is it that you, being a Jew, have anything to do with me? And then Pilate also calls him a Jew. So, that's very good. And that's basically.
Well, I've seen some of them acknowledge that he's Jewish, but it's like they're walking around with deaf ears. Yeah, so he's Jewish, and we're going to continue to believe in the doctrine we believe in.
That's my
problem. They don't understand it. They don't get a revelation of it.
There is so much to be said about that. So much. We'll go a different direction. All right. Very good. Well, Randy, that's highly appreciated. Let's do this like this for a second, and then we'll try to put this all together. Let's go to the front of the Torah Seder. And here, verse 28, and may the Lord give you the dew of the heavens and of the fatness of the earth and of the abundance of corn and wine. Nations will serve you and kingdoms will bow down to you. And you will be the master over your brothers and over your mother's sons. And they will bow down to you. Those who curse you will be cursed and those who bless you will be blessed. And it came to pass, As when Yitzhak had finished blessing Yaakov, and it came to pass Yaakov had just left his father's Yitzhak's presence, that the brother Esau came from the hunt. Now there's plenty to say and understand about this. It's interesting because the idea was for him to bring venison. And in some of the commentaries, they say he was only supposed to bring enough for Yitzhak, for Isaac. Not enough for the both of them together, not enough for the family meal, but just enough for him. So that meant that he's going to look for a rather small deer to accomplish this task. The reason why Yitzhak is making this specific demand is that he knows his son Esau. And he knows that he'll say, look, you know, here's what we can use to feed Dad, and I'll sell the rest to other people. And so he's going to make money off of this and a profit off of this, rather than, you know, monopolize the idea that he's trying to do something for his father, you know, and be a blessing to his father. But rather, Yitzhak knows this, so he makes this very specific, very, very specific request of Esau. Esau comes, and you get the feeling that, you know, it's just almost one door shuts and the other door opens, and, you know, here we are. We've gone through this process. Now, I'm going to give you my two cents, and my two cents doesn't mean anything, but I'm going to say it like this. When people look at this, it is very, very difficult to put your finger on whether Isaac knew that he was blessing Jacob, or whether he didn't know. And so you read it, and it's almost as if it can't be that he knows that this is Jacob, and that this is all a plot by Rivka and Jacob Yaakov to get this blessing that actually was going to go to Esau. No, I don't read it that way. I read it that Isaac knew exactly what's going down. Now, some of you, when you read this, you're having difficulty with it. I can understand. But let's stop for 1 second, and I think I said this last week, but it bears repeating on my account. You take someone of the spiritual stature of Yitzhak. His eminence was absolutely correct, and so don't think that I'm disagreeing with his eminence. Anyone can make a mistake. Has Isaac ever made a mistake? Absolutely. Did Abraham ever make a mistake? Absolutely. Did Jacob ever make a mistake? Absolutely. Go through the list, and you will find that everybody makes some sort of mistake somewhere. But now, here's the thing. You cannot take a man who is such a spiritual giant that, you know, here we go. We go up to the top of the mountain. God has told Abraham to sacrifice this man as a sacrifice. Now, this sacrifice, you want to know how old the boy is. He's not 13. He's not 12. He's not stupid. He doesn't know. It's not that he doesn't know what's going on. He's mentally astute enough. And some say he was in his 30s, and some say he's in his late 20s. Regardless of how you play it, he was aware of what was going on. And according to all the subsequent materials, the Oral Torah, it tells us that the reason that Isaac is bound on the altar and placed on the altar is because he told his father to do so. Because he understood the process. He knew what it took to make a burnt offering. Now, we're talking about a burnt offering. We're not talking about, you know, I'm just going to poke you with a knife and get a little blood and that's going to be the end of the story. This is what we call an olah in Hebrew. Olah is a very interesting word because it has the connotation of something that is ascending.
Aliyah.
Aliyah is a word in that family group. And so Yitzhak knows what's about to happen. And he knows that his dad's going to do this. So he tells his dad, he says, you need to tie my hands and my feet. And the idea of how it was tied is enough that you could just start to see the discoloration of the skin. You know what I'm talking about? You know, you can wrap something loosely around somebody's wrists and, you know, whatever. But when you bind it tight enough that it starts to make a little bit of a discoloration, you know you're pretty snug there. So he tells his father to do this, and the reason he wants his father to do this is because he doesn't want, at the moment when his father's going to make this sacrifice, for him to jerk and then invalidate himself as a burnt offering. I don't know if anybody's willing to go that route. And many people will say, did he or didn't he die? Did he offer him, etc.? There's, back to what we said a few minutes ago, there are numbers and numbers and numbers of opinions. And if you want to seek another opinion, you won't insult me in the least. It's very Jewish to do so. But I say, yes, he was in fact slaughtered and made an olah, a burnt offering. And frequently throughout Jewish literature, you will read where we look at the ashes of Isaac, and then we look at that as a form of redemption. Now, you take this person, who in my opinion, he was a burnt offering. How long was he God? Did he resurrect a couple days later? 3 days later? My opinion is about 3.5 years later. And according to now the more mystical sources, he sat in the school of Shem and Eber, the Celestial Academy. Now this is extremely difficult because
their academy is on earth.
Their academy is sitting on in Jerusalem. They had an academy there already. But he attends the Celestial Academy of Shem and Eber. But wait a minute, you just said that they're alive and they're on earth. Only alive on earth? Do they have access to the spiritual world? Are the words of the Torah being spoken in and out of the celestial kingdom at the same time?
Yes.
Wouldn't you be interested to look into the spiritual realm and see if any of the...
So he would have to be Minnesota?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, she falls off the camel. And we're talking about Rivka.
Falling off the wagon.
Well, this is just prior to that. Even before they had the wagon. She falls off of this because she sees some astounding sight. Now, I don't care, again, how you label this, how you try to explain it. She saw something very, very mystical. Whether it is just she saw the aura of the man who is her husband, or whatever you want to say. And she saw it, and she realized the spiritual grandeur of this individual who is going to be her husband, who she's betrothed to already, literally. My opinion is that he is coming back from the celestial or the spiritual realm. He's at a very specific well. It is very interesting. This well, the well of the living one who sees, or you can read it back and forward about 2 or 3 different ways, but it's interesting. Whenever people come in contact with this well, somebody's about to die, and then all of a sudden they get resurrected or built back up or restored or whatever you want to say. Now, I said all that because here is a man that is highly, highly spiritual. And he spent some time in the Celestial Academy, etc. And literally, they say in Gan Eden, which again associates with the Celestial Academy. There's so much when it comes to deeper and Seotic materials to try to flesh out. Now you can see the magnitude of the Book of John, and when you see the magnitude and the numbers of chapters, etc., you can understand why it is so big, because it has to try to work out several different issues that it can only be worked out through Seotic hermeneutic. Now, you're going to tell me that this guy who has existed on this deep spiritual plane and on this level, all of a sudden when it comes time to bless one or the other of the boys, he's dumbfounded and he doesn't know which he's got. And we'll see this same thing later on with Jacob, right? You know, he puts his hands on the boys, and Joseph says, no, Dad, it's like this. He puts his hands back because he knows what he's doing. I don't care if this one's this one and this one's this one. I know what I'm doing. He puts it on the right child. It's still a bit of the same scenario, too, isn't it? He's not supposed to be able to tell which one's which.
Kind of like Confederate flag, too.
Uh-huh. I've seen a couple of those. Everybody with me so far? And it's fine. If you don't agree, at least you'll have heard a theory that you could say Dr. O'Gleavy's knocked out, so that's fine. But I'm here to say what literally takes place is that here Yitzhak knows it's time to give this blessing. So he says, okay. Esau, come here, son. Yes, Dad. Go out and get me the food that I like. Fills in the parameters of, you know, just enough to feed me, nobody else. And then bring it back and cook it up and I'll give you a blessing. Did Isaac keep his word? Absolutely he did, didn't he?
Yeah.
He didn't say, I can't bless you, I can't give you a blessing. But the blessing that I gave to your brother, I can't give to you. But you're going to get a blessing. So he never lied in this situation to begin with. He never said, oh, guess what? You know, I tricked you. And you're not going to get a blessing. Now, some of the sages say that Rivka never told Yitzhak about the prophecy of the two children warring inside of her womb.
Wouldn't he have known?
Yeah, if he was her husband, I think he would share these things.
I would say, you know, you're going to go through your whole life, 100 plus years, and never tell your husband, oh yeah, by the way, you know, when I was having the kids.
Yeah, I snuck off, and I was gone for a few days, and you didn't know where I was gone.
Well, and I'm sure you could have seen it. I mean, it's, you know, when baby turns in the tummy, you see it.
Yeah, I think they were doing more than turning. So, here is Isaac, and I believe that he knew. And so what does he do? He disposes of his son so that he can accomplish the task that he has set out, and he and Rivka both know. And so, it's very interesting, of course, saying Yaakov is saying, Jacob is saying, oh mom, you know, Esau is a hairy man and I'm not a hairy man, blah, blah, blah. And so, she says, okay, what was it?
Hairy tallit.
It was a tallit. Let me ask you a question. It could have been the katan. Alright? So you'd wear the katan underneath clothes. As we have right now. Can you see our seat seat? We have them. It's a mystery. They're hidden. So, I think it was katan.
I don't know if they had katan at that time.
I would second that. I'm not sure exactly when this comes in. We can conjecture and say, you know, God told Adam such a thing, and perhaps so. But I want to say that it is perhaps quite, you want to keep the back of the room in the dark? is most probable, I would say, that this is not a tallit katan, the small undergarment that is worn. I'd say it is a tallit gadol, the garment that you see us wear on Shabbat, and weekdays should you see us praying on weekdays, etc. Now, I hope you can start to put these pieces of the puzzle together, because Esau is not going to be putting on this garment and then running around the field chasing a bunch of deer. Everybody with me? You see what I'm saying?
And if it was the garment that Hashem made Adam from the beginning, then it's a hairy, some made of a animal skin or
some form of a skin. Yeah, absolutely.
That's what Eliyahu wore, wasn't it?
Absolutely, it's sadness. What Yochanan said to wear something very similar, camel's hair.
It might have been the same one.
It may very well have been. There are some ideas, some midrashic ideas that it was, and that's all very, very possible and even probable. Okay, so Yaakov, his mother tells him to put on this garment, and he takes the food and he goes into the place where his father is seated, his father's room, whatever, tent, and Yitzhak reaches out to his son, and he pulls the son close, and he's saying, you know, yeah, the voice is the voice of Jacob, but this feels like Esau. Or maybe we could say it like this. This is the voice of Jacob, and he gets that from the way that that Jacob says that the Lord helped me. He uses the tetragrammaton, as we say, the reverential name of God. And so he is, in a certain sense, betrayed himself. What if I said no? If I said, he said this, and it's a signal to his dad exactly who it is.
I can't imagine. If my two sons could start talking to me, I would know it instantly. With the first word or two they say, I know who's talking to me.
So, here's the same situation, right? But he says this is the voice of Jacob. And in essence, he's saying exactly what you're saying. But when you have this, the Lord blessed me and the Lord helped me do this, that's not the way that Esau talks, so he knows it's Jacob saying these things.
Not only that, you can tell the difference between a deer and a calf. If you're even biting the meat, you can tell the difference between wild meat and game meat.
Your dog, you know, cat. So what I'm saying is that Isaac, he's not in the dark in this situation. If he knows, he says, you talk like Jacob, and then he puts his hands on him and he feels this talit. How old was Isaac at this juncture? He's nearly the same age as his mother. When she passed, 120 some years. 137 years, someone corrected me. Anyway, he's lived with these two boys all these years. How many times has he seen Esau put on this tallit? He knows the tallit. I would say he probably had his arms around his son more than once. But now here's my question. How many times do you think that he was in the presence, whether they're having a Shabbat prayer meeting or however it worked at that particular time, How many times do you think that he stood perhaps in the middle of his two boys and they are praying on Shabbat, and he has, let's just say he has Esau on the right and Yaakov on the left. He's sniffing to the right and he's sniffing to the left. And he's sniffing to the right and he's sniffing to the left. How many times do you think in these encounters that when he smelled to the right, that's what side Esau was on, that he smelled Donnie Dan? No guesses? He's wearing the tallit, the same tallit that we're talking about right here.
But if Esau was wearing it, he didn't smell Donnie Dan ever.
That's my point exactly.
Because he was,
I don't think he ever smelled Donnie Dan when his son Esau had that tallit on. Because he was not sincere in this whole issue. Now, if you want an interesting read, you can go perhaps to His Honor's webpage, hunt down this idea of Esau selling his birthright, and him coming in from the field, and he was famished. He was to the point of collapse, and he wanted a bowl, if you will, of that red stuff.
Oh, they make it.
Why was he so famous?
Kill him. Kill him.
Say it again?
Kill him.
Killing, raping, pillaging, and plundering. And no sweat for me to sell my birthright, because it doesn't mean anything to me. Obviously it doesn't. Now I said that because I believe that Yitzhak is not stupid. And while we can say, yes, he was definitely an old man, blah, 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 doesn't mean he was absolutely senile. And not capable of discerning what was going on. But when he takes his son and he puts his hands on his son, Jacob, he does what? He smells the smell of Donnie Dan.
Is he no sinner?
And he knows it's the righteous son.
So you're not, with that whole scenario, it should be speaking something to us from Mordecai. It says, you are
God's son. The son. A son. Change it back to the son.
I mean, it would work either way.
Absolutely.
And it's not either or, it's really both.
No, absolutely. Yeah, not a problem. No way, not a problem at all. So which son did we pick? The son. But now look at this. Bring it back to, I said all this to get to this place right here. Next week I'm really going to tear you guys up, so you guys better be ready. I'm laying the foundation. Page 26. Keep your 26. This is quite important, so keep your finger there. I'm going to read you just this verse, and it relates to the piece in Mordecai or Mark. And, I'm just going to paraphrase this, and he got finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob went out from his father's presence. Now, according to a couple of commentaries on the deeper end, Zohar, Zohar, Kamor, Ben Yichai, some here indicate that when Jacob left, when it's saying here that he left his father's presence, you know, he took his father's presence. Or he took his father's divine presence. He had passed the divine presence that rested on him to the son Jacob. And so when Jacob leaves, the presence goes with him. The divine presence goes with him. Now Isaac will know straight up that he cannot bless Esau in the same manner, but he can still pass a blessing. Okay? But it said just as soon as this happened, one left and the other came in from the hunt. Now the million-dollar question. Someone else pointed out that now in Mark here, in Mordecai, it's the son, the right one, regardless of other possibilities, etc. This is the right one, okay? Now, setting that thought aside for a second, is there any other way that you can connect these opening verses, this opening verse, and all of these demons, blah, 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 blah? How would that connect with what we just got done reading?
Uncleanliness.
So you're associating uncleanliness with what? Whom?
With Esau.
Very good. So in other words, we can see that what Mark is trying to say is that this guy doesn't have any virtue in comparison to this son. The son, right? Or we can now say, in a matter of speaking, we can make Yeshua Jacob and Jacob Yeshua. Okay, we're not supposed to do this in Peshat, but we'll stretch the borders now. We're beyond Peshat. Okay? Who knows where we're at, but we're not in Peshat anymore. Well, you know, yeah, for sure. Not in Kansas anymore, Toto.
So the demons are totally aware of the transaction that took place long ago. Because the world, and though it's invisible to people in the world, it's a cosmic reality of the way the world is functioning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So just because you can't see it doesn't mean that it's not working. Okay? Now, let me ask you a question. Did you look up, Gerrit Shevet, did you look up shading and see what they were? It's not shades on the windows, but
no.
So you understand the way that it read that we're speaking about demons here, more or less, right? Let's just don't relegate these things to a bunch of little imps running around.
The powers and principalities.
Which powers and principalities?
The negative. The ones that have been appropriated to...
According to the sources, Shadim, these, not just a bunch of little devils running around trying to create havoc. Shadim, and specifically the Shadim that Yeshua is contending with, are not just...
Are they the third of the angels that fell?
They, no, not necessarily. They are angels who are in high authority and in power over foreign governments. Now look at this particular thing and see what's going on. This is not just an encounter with Yeshua and a few of these little devils, that it's no contest to overcome this.
That brings us back to Daniel chapter
10. Absolutely, absolutely. And that's what we should be thinking of, very much along those lines. But here, then you can see this on the grandeur of what is truly happening in this area and what Yeshua was doing. You may or may not have heard of the saying of Galilee of the Nations, okay? This phrase, the Galilee of the Nations, is somewhat misunderstood, let's say. But it's not difficult to understand that the Galilee did have many people from other nations who had come here. It was the first of the two kingdoms that were driven. It was the first of the two to be drug off into exile. And so many others came here. We know the story, or you should know the story of the Samaritans. The Samaritans were put in this general geography. They had a tremendous problem. They were afraid to go out at night. Why? There were lion, tigers, everything else in the whole world in there waiting for them, you know, to step outside. They had no way of defending themselves. Not just because they didn't have a shotgun or an arrow, a bow and arrow, is because this is a spiritual environment. And so they had a resolve. What was the resolve they had? They called to the king of Babylon and said, "We need instruction from the people who used to live here on how to live. We need to know their laws, their practices, etc." So, the Babylonians do what? They send a couple of Hasidic Jews over there. Now, they accepted many, many of the mitzvot, the practices, etc. But, you know, we got to, you know, we came from over here, so we still got to mix in a few of our own.
Possibly, too, there was the thing during Ezra's time who were supposed to depose their wives, their Gentile wives,
right,
and wouldn't do it, probably joined up with them.
It, that is very much one of the scenarios that it has played out. Absolutely. So, those things I'm saying because now you talk about Galilee of the Nations, you can understand that the difficulty of the fall of the Northern Kingdom, and you can understand that people would want to populate this area. But here's Yeshua on this particular place, in this particular place, doing a tremendous work of cleaning up the Galilee. Not just cleaning it up, you know, saying, okay, you know, you guys quit throwing your litter in the Sea of Galilee and, you know, having a policing situation. He brought back true spirituality to the Galilee.
He was cleaning up the spiritual atmosphere.
Absolutely. He addressed the spiritual atmosphere. And so here you see that, you know, you got some guy riding across the hill with his camel and he's got his idol in there with him.
When you look at the word, it means foreign gods.
Wow!
Imagine so that. You've kind of got a microcosm of the world right there.
Absolutely.
And even a launching pad until the rest of the world.
Well, isn't it interesting that having this microcosm like this, that everything you need to initiate a tikkun for this exile is right in front of you. Mm-hmm. It's like being in the middle of a vineyard and the grapes are just oozing with rape ooze, whatever that would be.
So that would kind of identify part of his major ministry right there, being right there, and that's where the northern tribes were.
Absolutely.
You can come back now.
And I wrote in one of these it will only really minister to those of us who were, remember our childhood days a little while back, and we used to play Kick the Can. Remember Kick the Can?
Oh, yeah.
Ollie, Ollie, Oxen Free. What does that mean? Everybody can come in now. Come on, you that are hiding behind the trees, and you that are out here, and we can't find more, means you come back, and you come back free. So, I think it's quite evident, in my mind, and you don't have to agree with me, that's fine. I'm just giving a scenario here. But if you use it, you have to say, I did it. I said it. At least to open your mind and see that this is a possibility. We watch Jacob go out. It's interesting, right? Jacob goes out into exile. In the very end of, the very beginning actually, of our Torah Seder, you know, the door closes. This is like, you know, watching the movies, you know, the door closes. Here goes Jacob. Here comes Esau. You open up here in the scenario of Yeshua in the Galil, and the door closes to the exile of the kingdoms, and here comes Yeshua. Does that make sense? Now, if you look at Acts, page 26, said, and they ceased not to teach the Masorah of the Master or Messiah daily in the Beit HaMikdash and from house to house. In other words, they had a plan. That mean anything to anyone other than myself? Say again, sir, please.
Say again, sir, please.
I said they were following the Mishnah.
Mishnah?
Mishnah?
What about the, calendar?
House of studies, and sit at the feet of your rabbi, turn up the quote from Perkei Avot.
Yeah, you can do that. Let's understand something.
Let's understand.
In you're right on, Gabriel, so I just want to extend this just a little bit. He's picking up on page 30. If you look at page 30, he said, let your house be a meeting for the sages, and sit amongst the dust of their feet, and drink in their words with thirst. Now I went back to 1 Lucas 10 and 38, and the scenario with Martha and Mary. Everybody should pretty much remember that. And said that, the one sister, Miriam, is sitting at the feet of the Master and listening in to his teachings. We could easily have said he was drinking in his words, etc., right? And then Martha is upset at this, and so she tries to get the Master to, reprimand her sister for not doing this, and said, well, tell you the truth, she's doing the right thing. She didn't like that very much, maybe, but that's what it is. So, Gabriel is alluding to this passage and to this idea. But let's understand that even though we start here with the Mishnah, the very simplistic teachings, Mishnah, a repetition of a second of the Torah, as it were. But we can also understand, and the reason sometimes if you look at what I do, in the Mishnah part of the text in the Markian text and commentary, I limit myself very much to Peshat. But then as soon as we get to Remez, the horse is out of the gate. And we can take off. And so then I try to unfold things that are on a bit of a deeper level, on more of a Remez level, which relates to the Talmud. Remez is Talmud. So, when you read the Mishneh part, you can pretty much say, yeah, this is Peshat. But now I lift pieces of Peshat out during discussions so that we can show that you start with Peshat, you have this very simplistic idea or phrase, but when it's lifted out by Remez, when it's lifted out by Midrash or Sa'od, it's lifted out and then we draw on the deeper meanings of it.
It sprouts wings.
Absolutely. So, the question I asked Sheva some time ago was, which is the most spiritual of all the books? Of the Gospels, as it were. She Googled it and she sent me back an answer.
And I was wrong.
And I said, and still say, though you can argue, that's fine with me, Mark. Because it's all in there. Everything John needs is in there. And if you get good enough at reading Mark, then when you start to read John, what will you read? He said, I see where he got that idea from. Who's he trying to fool? I say that because I allude to the fact that, yeah, they were going from house to house teaching the Masorah, but the Masorah is not limited to just the Mishneh. How would you like to have been in the presence of Yochanan or Hans Chacham Sofer? I'm going to tell you. Teaching a lesson. You know, if you sit down with John, you know pretty much what he's going to say. You know, he's going to really get into this sort of thing. But what I'd like to do is just unfetter. Comes a fit. Say, we're not in Mishnah anymore, Gansafet. Let the soul flow. Not to demean John. Truly a giant, though. Giant of giants. But wouldn't it be interesting? Won't it be interesting? We said in that celestial kingdom, or that celestial academy, someone is saying, what on earth? Something bad was said. It's not here, it's all right. What is he saying? America, what? Okay, I'm at the end of my discussion. I think I've made my point. I hope I've made my point. I hope that you were able to connect your cars together. So at this point, I will open the room for questions and comments.
There are minutes. When he says, this is the way I look at it, is when he says that they went teaching the Masorah of Yeshua, his Masorah, as we understand it, was basically the same as Masorah of Hillel.
Absolutely.
But the dominant one at that point was the Masorah of Shammai.
Correct.
And so it would be something really to say that he was emphasizing the Masorah of Hillel.
Correct. So we could just truly say, without any difficulty, they went house to house teaching the Masorah of Hillel. And it not be a problem for us. But we could understand there still would be a considerable amount of difficulty, right? From what we learned last week or the week before with the right-handed guy that he didn't know anything but Dean, right? So this is Shammai. So Dean, not only there so much Dean, not only is so much Dean, they were against the Gentiles. So now when we look at this particular piece of Mark, we can also say, oh, yeah, Yeshua was solving that problem as well, right? If these, what did it say, foreign gods? He's subordinating, Yeshua is subordinating the nations in solving the Shemite problem. And so, it's very interesting. Jews, when we talk about intermediaries, okay? So an intermediary, you understand, is like, for example, an intermediary could be an angelic spirit, like Dr. Elisheva said about Daniel. Okay? You've got Michael fighting with these particular angels, and they're trying to...
The angels of Persia.
The prince of Persia, and, you know, what he's been able to do is make a break so that Gabriel can come bring this message to Daniel to say, we heard it. Okay? But you see that there's a subordinating of these intermediaries. This angel is, a lord over Persia. That's the Gentiles. That's the way the nations of the Gentiles, they are. They have some spirit like that over them. But now you see that Yeshua is subordinating all of those spirits.
Well, they're making a confession like Esau did. Where he said, do you have a blessing for me too? Well, he said, you are a son or the son.
Yeah, exactly.
So they're subordinating themselves.
They realize who he is. They know who he is. And they know that their place and position is only subordination. Does that make sense to everyone? But this, see what this does for the Gentiles now? We'll leave that term in loose at present, but actually we're not just hunting just Gentiles. Gentiles, we're hunting Gentiles with a fragment. Did you ever wonder what else could have been going on with Isaac out in the middle of that field? I'm going to give you a hint for next week.
That's of course.
Said he was looking at all of the sparks. Peering into the spiritual world, looking and looking and looking, and determining which ones he would make the tikkun for. That's pretty big for me. Maybe it didn't. Do anything for you, but that's something for me. Any other questions or comments? I won't tell you the rest until next week.
Your Eminence?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Could you look at page 26? Your footnote there, 49, and talk about that a little bit.
Page 26?
Back to the idea of the... Oh, I'm sorry, 27. Back to the idea of the day of Elohim.
On page 27. Oh, Ben.
49.
Okay. You understand that different names are given to the heads of Beit Din, etc., right? Mm-hmm. Gaon, as was used in Sephardi lands where Sephardi Jews were resident, would be the same as the phrase Nasi. Okay, Nasi means
president, right?
It's like a prince. It's the same phrase as Gaon. Okay? So each one of these, and I hope this is answering your question, Marvin. If not, please speak up. But each one of these, of the Hakamim, the sages, that Hakamim just is a phrase meaning a sage, someone who is grown to the level of Chokhmah or wisdom. So the Gionim and the Gaon, these are the same titles, prince, as Nasi in Eretz Israel. So, for example, Hillel, as we were just speaking of a moment ago, was the Nasi of the Sanhedrin. He's the president of the Sanhedrin, but he's called a prince. Now, it's interesting because Nasi has the idea of being, it can be several things. It can be a miracle, or it can mean like something at the top. Okay? Very much like
a banner or a flag.
A banner or a flag, something that's at the top of the pole, waving at the top of the pole, etc. And by the way, as a footnote to the footnote, I would venture to say, I've not investigated this thoroughly, but I would venture to say it was probably a Kabbalistic Jew of some connection that came up with the acronym NASA.
Means to soar in heaven.
To soar through the heavens. To the heights of the heavens. Okay. So.
Yes. I understand that. I guess what got my attention was that last sentence or two, that the rabbis and the Hakamim are embodiments not only of the written and oral Torah, but an embodiment of the Messiah, King of Israel.
Absolutely.
And I guess as I read that, I just heard a little echo from Saul in the Nazarene Codicil. It didn't strike me as strange. It's just like, I don't quite understand that, but, you know, it seemed to have a true ring to it.
Yeah, what we're trying to say here, again, is back to the idea that in your neck of the woods, people that you have an opportunity to speak with, and perhaps sometimes you can do it intentionally, or sometimes things happen unintentionally, but in some respects you're like a judge to them, and I'm not saying you go around judging their deeds, etc., but at the same time you lift a particular standard and show them the standard. But just in the same as you're somewhat of a judge or a standard for people to watch, to see, etc., you're in the same vein, you are Messiah, the embodiment of Messiah to the people that are in your circle of influence. Now, none of us are saying, you know, we're going to become some cult or anything silly like that. But the idea is to be realistic enough to note that, you know, if my employer asked me, said, why don't you eat that ham sandwich? You know, I'm telling him, it's not right. And if you want me to push, I'll show you in the scripture it's not right. But basically what I do in my circle, and maybe you do in yours as well, I just leave the door open, you know. I said, no thanks, that's not for me, and, you know, I'm Jewish, we don't do that, and we base it on this particular set of verses. So you're not being dogmatic about it, but then, you know, people that are genuinely curious will say, well, I don't know more about that, you know. And so in that respect, each time that you have an opportunity to speak with them, you are Messiah to them in many, many respects. I think it gets much deeper than that.
That's the old adage, though, Christian, that you might be the only Bible that some man will ever see. That's your microcosm of Messiah.
Exactly. But it's going to take us fulfilling and living out that role for the days of Messiah to truly unfold and begin. You know, if you stop to figure out how it's all going to happen, and you look at the world we're living in today, you say, I don't know how it's going to happen. I came to that place. I came to that hurdle, and I said, I don't either. But then, you know, the light turned on, and I said, well, it's not stupid. It's not all that difficult. He's not going to come down and do some miracle and then twist your arm in the back and make you keep the mitzvah. The mitzvah. You're going to say, look, I don't need a commandment to tell me not to throw trash in my neighbor's yard. And you know what? Yeah, keeping Shabbat. Yeah, that's the right thing to do. So are you ready to put on your Messiah robe and start walking the streets up there at Old Marvin? Looks like he's having some difficulty with this.
We could, signal's bad.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. It looks like the signal's bad. I guess we could jump up and say, get people to jump up and down and say, I am Messiah.
I started to say, what you eat that? Because I'm Messiah.
That was over real well.
Yeah, they have good folk losing about that, how well that worked.
They already don't like it. Make it that much worse.
You'd be locked in the freezer then.
Oh, Lord.
Does that shield out the telephone signal?
Yeah.
In the freezer?
It would be.
We have a Sheva sickle.
Sheva sickle.
At least I won't go on with any thought, peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Enough cases in there.